It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're in Body Week, exploring heart disease risks and key indicators to watch for, maintenance strategies for hypertension and high cholesterol that elevate the risk of heart attack and stroke. Call in with your questions about all aspects of heart health, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Robert Wilson is a cardiologist with Appleton-based Heart and Vascular Institute of Wisconsin. Dr. Wilson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. We also have Dr. Ivor Benjamin, a cardiologist and director of the Medical College of Wisconsin Cardiovascular Center in Milwaukee, where he's a professor of medicine. Dr. Benjamin, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a fan of your show.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, Dr. Benjamin, let's start with you. Heart disease, the leading cause of death in our country. Why is that?
Well, it's an obviously important question that you're asking, and we know a number of things about heart disease. We know about the risk factors for heart disease, such as, for example, as you mentioned earlier, hypertension and diabetes, high cholesterol, maybe obesity. And there are just these confluence of factors that affect people of all ages, all races, ethnicities. It's independent of your socioeconomic status. And they somehow are the factors. We talk about the risk factors that contribute to this high prevalence and incidence of cardiovascular disease. Now, those, of course, might be the bad news. There is good news. And so I'm delighted that Dr. Wilson and I can take the rest of the hour to really be able to explore not only what are the risk factors for heart disease, but what are the specific things listeners of your show can do today, not only for themselves, but for their loved ones on this Super Bowl week.
Well, thank you for that. And Dr. Wilson, typical to people in media, we're going to get to the good news eventually, but what types of heart disease are you most frequently seeing in your patients in the clinical setting?
Well, I think that related to what Dr. Benjamin mentioned, coronary artery disease, vascular disease in general, is probably the number one problem. And people are at risk when they have the risk factors that have been mentioned. There's definitely a genetic predisposition, and it's, I think Dr. Benjamin used the term confluence of factors, and that's what it is. The more risk factors you have, the greater your risk for developing a problem. So heart attacks, stroke, problems with blood flow to the legs, PAD, now known to the public by that term. Those are all of the things that we see, and we see in a great number.
How difficult is treating advanced heart disease, particularly in the elderly?
That's difficult not only because of the heart disease tends to be further along, but often there are problems in other organ systems. The lungs may be affected. The kidneys may be affected. Strength, balance, coordination may be affected. So as a specialist, I have to take care not to put the blinders on and focus only on the heart, but have to take the patient's entire health into consideration. It is more difficult to take care of elderly people who have other health problems. Their hospitalizations are longer, their recoveries are slower. So it's more of a chore for the patient, the family, and the physician.
Talking about cardiac health, getting your questions answered with Wisconsin cardiologists, Dr. Robert Wilson there. We have Dr. Ivor Benjamin as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mark in New Berlin. Mark, hi. What would you like to ask the cardiologists?
Hi, I'm 75. I'm pretty healthy. I hike, I bike, I kayak. I also take warfarin because I've had atrial fibrillation, and I've read articles now that this can lead to calcification, and I had a calcium scan and it's pretty low, but I'm just wondering if I should be switching to one of the other drugs.
Mark, thank you for that. Dr. Benjamin, explaining a bit about AFib and irregular and very rapid heart rhythms and how that is managed through medications.
It's a great question that Mark asked, and I particularly was impressed that he hikes and he bikes and he's got a low calcium score. But notwithstanding those factors, we know that atrial fibrillation is very common. Some of the most common risk factors is hypertension. Let me begin by just saying, what is atrial fibrillation? That we normally have a well-defined rhythm that we call normal sinus rhythm. And atrial fibrillation is when there is lack of that coordination between the upper chambers of the heart and the lower chambers of the heart, such that the atrial rate actually becomes chaotic, it's not organized, and it may actually go and become as high as 170, if not higher. It can have significant symptoms with patients, but more importantly, to Mark's point, is that it can actually create areas of the heart where clots can form. And when clots form within the upper chamber of the heart, those clots can dislodge. And one of the important areas when they dislodge is that it goes to the brain. Mm. So we are able now to use blood thinners. Warfarin, Coumadin has been on the market for decades. But there are other types of anticoagulants that are actually able now to really be able to reduce the potential risk of having strokes with atrial fibrillation. And most definitely, it can be managed pharmacologically using drugs, but there are also interventions that our electrophysiologists can do to intervene on atrial fibrillation. The most important thing is to recognize it, to come in the care of physicians like myself and Dr. Wilson, and I think he can speak about that. And importantly, be sure that you, if you have the appropriate risk factors, that you're on an anticoagulant to prevent stroke, which is a dreaded complication.
Dr. Wilson, what comes up for you as you manage and treat atrial fibrillation?
Well, it is a consideration of the underlying causes: hypertension, sleep apnea, valvular heart disease. So there's an array of predisposing factors that have to be considered. And then as Mark's question points out, treatment for the stroke risk. Just as an aside, warfarin has been around for decades. And the first four letters of warfarin stand for Wisconsin Agricultural Research Foundation.
Wow.
Because it was developed at UW many, many years ago. And for quite a while, it was the only game in town when it came to treating the risk of atrial fibrillation. But there are newer agents that are somewhat more convenient in that they don't require monitoring of blood tests. And those are becoming a little more affordable. When they first came out, they were quite expensive, as many new medications are. But now they've been around for a while, and they're a little more affordable. Speaking to Mark's question about the calcification of the arteries, the anticoagulation medicines are really not for vascular disease. They're not effective. They're to prevent clots in the chambers of the heart or in the leg veins. But I don't know if I answered your question, but we have to think about a lot of things when somebody comes in with atrial fibrillation, the underlying cause, and then, of course, the approach to management. And Dr. Benjamin touched on those possibilities.
Dr. Robert Wilson, a cardiologist in Appleton. Dr. Ivor Benjamin leads the Medical College of Wisconsin's Cardiovascular Center. Join in with your heart health questions, comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn ways to reduce the risk of heart disease and stroke with a pair of Wisconsin cardiologists fielding your questions. Heart disease, the leading cause of death in Wisconsin, according to CDC figures. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have cardiologists Ivor Benjamin and Robert Wilson. They stay with us. We heard from Keegan in Minocqua who called in, and Keegan in their late 30s, trying to be healthy. They already take omega fatty acid pills and B2 vitamins and say that their levels are good and want to know what they can do to keep up this effort. Dr. Benjamin, what would you suggest?
Great question. And, you know, the American Heart Association, as you know, have been involved with the Heart Association for a little while now, but it's actually come up with Life Essential 8. And it's particularly designed for someone in their 30s so that they can then, if you will, adopt a lifestyle around what's called these Essential 8s. And of course, Keegan has already mentioned about diet, but physical activity. Before coming on the show, I was asked, you know, what did I, you know, do this morning? Well, I made sure that I got on my, you know, on my treadmill for 30 minutes. And we know that at least doing that five times a week for 150 minutes per week is part of just not only maintaining good heart health, but good brain health. And I also think, as Dr. Wilson will attest, it affects all of those other risk factors. Number one, if you don't smoke, don't start. That's absolutely true for sure. Being able to obviously maintain good body weight, you'll be able to affect your lipids. Let's go on and talk a little bit more about your blood glucose and blood pressure. We've already talked about some of the risk factors that blood pressure have, but everyone should really be able to monitor one's own blood pressure. And the final one I really want to bring up is what's new to the Essential 8, and that has to do with sleep health. Dr. Wilson did mention that in relation to being a risk factor. But as I think sleep hygiene is something that we're learning a whole lot more about. It not only affects the heart, it affects the brain. So just look up, you know, Life Essential 8, keep up the good work. And I think that, you know, while Dr. Wilson and I, you know, are specialists, we're here, but we'll much prefer to know that people go on and have having a life free of heart disease and stroke.
Dr. Wilson, you know, that is a list there of things that we really need to do in our lives and keep in mind. But that one piece there, blood pressure, what is the link between uncontrolled high blood pressure and heart health?
Well, the high blood pressure puts a burden directly on the heart, and that causes a number of abnormalities over time. And that is the difficulty with high blood pressure, because it really doesn't create a lot of symptoms in the majority of patients. And people have extreme high blood pressure, they will develop headaches, nosebleeds, visual difficulties. But the average person with high blood pressure, say a systolic of 140, 150, or 160, is not going to have symptoms. But the damage is being done day in, day out. Dr. Benjamin mentioned home blood pressure monitoring. It's extremely important. And I do spend a lot of time talking to patients about this. And I point out to them that when they come in the office, we get one number to make a judgment out about their blood pressure, and that's completely inadequate. And if they get in the habit of checking their blood pressure, keeping a log, writing it down so that it imprints on the brain, then if they come into the office and they've taken their blood pressure 2-3 times a week, maybe we can go over the numbers and see how they're doing. Everyone's blood pressure will vary 20, 30, even 40 points throughout the day. And you want to make sure you're varying in an acceptable range, you know, 110 to 140 rather than 140 to 170. And so it's very important. It takes its toll over a long, long time. we can see the effects of high blood pressure in some of our testing, the EKG, the echocardiogram. But it's better not to get to the point of having those what we would call subclinical abnormalities, where the patient already has structural heart problems and is unaware of it. It's better to head that off at the pass, if you can, by getting good treatment.
Talking about cardiac health, taking your questions, Dr. Ivor Benjamin, Dr. Robert Wilson at 800-642-1234. Dr. Benjamin, what are the options today for controlling high blood pressure? What are people being prescribed, and how is that medicine evolving?
I want to begin by really picking up, Kate, what Dr. Wilson just identified about being able to monitor your blood pressure. And I want to also emphasize that the chronic effects of high blood pressure on the heart actually takes its toll in a number of ways that we call, one of those particular dreaded conditions is called heart failure. Now, I didn't necessarily say somehow you're a failure, but this is a condition in which the heart is unable to meet the body's peripheral demands. And it manifests itself in a number of ways, with shortness of breath. Obviously, there is edema, and there are a number of other signs and symptoms of heart failure. So we begin, for example, of course, with the consequences of the heart and the kidneys. All of a sudden, the kidneys begin to feel as though it needs to be holding on to fluid when in fact it should not. So taking a diuretic is part of just standard maintenance of high blood pressure control, particularly when the kidneys begin to fail. But the other quick point I want to point out is that they are in particular populations where there are certain kinds of consequences of high blood pressure. And that's particularly in the context of African Americans.
Yes.
Now, you can actually have a blockage of your vessel and you can have a heart attack and you can get heart failure. But sustained hypertension has a disproportionate effect in African Americans, where it then goes on not only to heart failure, but chronic kidney disease. And this constellation of factors, I think, means that we need to have a heightened sense of awareness and all of the issues that you're discussing on this show this morning. So I want to thank you for really being able to increase not only the awareness, but for us to be having this conversation about what all populations, but specific populations, must do in order for us to address and tackle the root causes of cardiovascular disease in our communities.
And you've done research on cardiovascular disparities. And what have you learned through that research? What is a key takeaway when it comes to the dire statistics for Black Americans?
Well, it's an important question. And those disparities, I think, speak for themselves. One of which, of course, is that we should not be able to actually have premature deaths in our communities. We've got amazing interventions, be it drugs, you know, obviously there is surgery, there is valvular heart disease. We have really actually come a long way. But when heart disease begins to start manifesting itself, it's more than just the heart. It involves multiple systems. And those systems are primarily the brain, the heart, the other aspects of the vasculature, and it makes it so much more difficult. There is an economic burden. There is a withdrawal from one's being able to participate in the workforce. Mm. All of these have a multiplying effects on families.
And we need to pause right there with cardiologist Ivor Benjamin, Robert Wilson as well. You can join in 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about heart disease, symptoms, risk factors, prevention, and the good news. The state health department, though, says 1 in 3 deaths are attributed to heart attacks or strokes. Call in with what your questions are about the heart. Share your experiences. Advice for staying healthy, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. Robert Wilson, a cardiologist with Heart and Vascular Institute of Wisconsin, and Dr. Ivor Benjamin, a cardiac disease researcher, leads Medical College of Wisconsin's Cardiovascular Center. We heard from Bob in Two Rivers, Dr. Wilson. Bob has been diagnosed with tachycardia, and they're wondering what is the difference between that disease and atrial fibrillation?
Tachycardia is kind of an umbrella term. It covers a lot of different types of heart rhythms. Tachycardia specifically means the heart's going too fast, and somewhat arbitrarily, the upper limit of normal is 100 beats per minute. Most people are well below that at rest. But tachycardia can be persistent. It can be episodic. And the type of tachycardia that he has would determine the approach, what kind of diagnostic testing we would have, and what kind of treatment he would have. So we would need to know the species of the tachycardia, just what kind he is dealing with. So that we could drill down on what he needs to do about it.
Let's spend some time here on pacemakers. In 1985, you implanted your first biventricular pacemaker. How is the technology of implantable devices advancing in heart medicine?
Well, I guess I would have to tip my hat to the industry, the folks who engineer, design, and manufacture the pacemakers have done a very good job of making them better, more patient-friendly, easier to monitor over time. The one drawback for pacemakers is still that they do require a lead or a fine insulated wire that passes from the pacemaker generator down into the heart chambers. And in the perfect world, we wouldn't have that lead because it is a source of infection in some people. A small number, but it is the one drawback for pacemaker technology. But pacemakers have done a great thing for people to treat their low heart rates. That was the original reason for pacemakers when people had bradycardia or slow heart rate. It has evolved into a treatment for threatening tachycardias, sudden cardiac death types of heart rhythms. So that's what a defibrillator is, and that has transformed the lives of many people. It has saved the lives of many people. And then the last one, the one that you mentioned, is a biventricular pacemaker. That is pacing both lower chambers of the heart to improve the heart function, and that is for people who have heart failure, the problem that Dr. Benjamin referred to earlier, where their hearts are sluggish and they have shortness of breath and easy fatigability, that sort of thing. So it's come a long, long way, and it continues to improve. As I mentioned, for the patients, it's the ease of use or the ease of having a pacemaker has improved because they're easier to monitor now than they were years ago.
Dr. Benjamin, when you look at the landscape of research and technology on pacemakers, when is it recommended and when is medication a preferred route, or do you do both?
So it actually turns out, in addition to those devices and improvement that you, Dr. Wilson, mentioned with the industry. I'm not here to endorse any particular product, but they are actually devices that we put on our hands or watch that are actually able to do a pretty good job recognizing things like atrial fibrillation. So people can actually, just with a wearable device, can identify when you know, their heart might be slower, have things like atrial fibrillation. But I do think that there are times when, of course, the heart could either be too fast or too slow, and they have to come, you know, under the direct care of a cardiologist. And that will require, of course, getting information from a Holter monitor. There are times if you're going too fast, you may need a beta blocker. There are calcium channel agents that are able to slow the rate at which there is communication between the upper chambers and the lower chambers. And there are obviously times less frequently when we're able to use medications to speed the heart up. But for the most part, people have symptoms when they're going too quickly, and we're generally trying to rate control whatever particular tachycardia they may be dealing with.
Dr. Ivor Benjamin there, Dr. Robert Wilson as well, cardiologist, taking your questions on heart health at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jim in Camp Douglas. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. Yeah, if your speaker could say some things about the ablation procedure to help remedy forms of tachycardia or increased heart rate. That would be beneficial if I could hear him say some things about that.
Dr. Wilson, do you want to go ahead there?
Sure. Is there a specific kind of heart rhythm that you are interested in or concerned about?
One that where the procedure would cause it to stop looping and then just have it proceed on its normal path, relieving of that accelerated heart rate.
Okay, that sounds like a supraventricular tachycardia that that does have a circuit or a loop, as you describe, and that can frequently be interrupted or destroyed, I guess, with a procedure called radiofrequency ablation. It's where energy is applied to that circuit and it knocks it out, so it prevents that rapid loop, that rapid tachycardia. And most of those are what are called AV nodal reentrant tachycardias. Sometimes atrial flutter can be knocked out in a similar way. It's a fairly straightforward procedure most of the time, and it has a very, very high success rate. So it's something that people can be troubled with it for years. Try medications, which are maybe somewhat effective, but then they have this procedure and they're thrilled to be done with that supraventricular tachycardia. And it is just because an energy burst was applied at the right place along that pathway that allowed that loop to occur.
Jim, thank you for the call. Let's go to Jeff in Sullivan. Jeff, what would you like to bring up?
I would like the physicians to speak to the issues of excessive alcohol consumption and what it does to the heart and the circulatory system.
Jeff, thanks. Dr. Benjamin.
It's an important question. We obviously consume alcohol as part of our social interactions, but there is a substantial amount of peer-reviewed scientific evidence to support alcohol's direct effects on the heart, ranging from alterations in the circuitry causing arrhythmias, but also direct toxic effects on different types of heart cells, such as the muscle heart cells that are called cardiac myocytes, their direct effects on the lining cells that are called endothelial cells, as well as what we call vasculopulmonary muscle cells. So too much of anything isn't good. And certainly alcohol is part of our social fabric. And we know, and we have to have those conversations with friends and family and all of our lives to really be able to moderate the control of alcohol at its inception in terms of having moderate use. but it's a huge and important question. And I think I thank the caller for just really being able to bring it up, because the solution is beyond just medicine per se, but having those broader professionals who can have an impact on its control.
I'm thinking about primary care physicians who do ask the question in a regular physical, you know, how many drinks do you have in a week? How should we think about that question and the answer?
Well, I don't want to dominate all this. I want to hear first from Dr. Wilson.
Deferring to Dr. Wilson here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the standard recommendation, it is still a standard recommendation, although it may be changing, is that men should have no more than two alcoholic drinks in a day, and women no more than one. So I guess if you tally up your weekly total, it would be 14 for men and 7 for women. An alcoholic beverage being a 5-ounce glass of wine, a 12-ounce bottle of beer, or a 1.5-ounce jigger of distilled spirits. So in Wisconsin, it's a part of the culture. I think I can safely generalize here. We drink more, and we have these discussions with our patients, and it's kind of a challenge sometimes to talk about alcohol and its relationship to health without sounding preachy. And that's really the goal, is to inform people without judging them. They need the information, and then they make the decision on their own. But those amounts that I talked about, two drinks for men, one drink for women, are sort of the standard recommendation at this point. There are some who feel even that amount is too much.
We have a pair of Wisconsin cardiologists with us, Robert Wilson and Ivor Benjamin, fielding your heart health questions during our Body Week, calling about all different types of heart problems, your experiences, what you want to know about treatments and outcomes, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's Body Week here, and we focus on the heart and circulatory system. Join the conversation. Call in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Dr. Robert Wilson is a cardiologist in Appleton, and Dr. Ivor Benjamin is a professor of medicine and director of the Cardiovascular Center at Medical College of Wisconsin. Let's go to Steve in Lake Geneva. Steve, hi.
Hi there. Just have a quick comment. We know that sustained elevated stress levels have an adverse effect on cardiovascular health. There's also a growing wealth of evidence that certain environmental factors like noise and light pollution, which is now growing at an estimated annual rate of 10%, have a tremendously damaging impact on our physiology, including cardiac health. It follows that a major focus should be on minimizing all forms of pollution and encouraging more people to get outside and connect with nature, which has proven to have real efficacy in reducing stress levels, calming our nerves. And I think more healthcare workers understand that, and as well as architects. And there's a growing effort to rethink how we do more things in these domains.
Steve, thank you. Yes, thank you. Dr. Benjamin, can you pick up on these comments?
Steve brings up an important point, and it gives us a chance to really think in this final segment. We were talking just about the risk factors for heart disease, but that conversation has actually evolved in what we call the social determinants of health. Where we live, where we work, how we're able to engage in a variety of things. We know that there are many, many social factors that are now influencing our health, including cardiovascular health. Just recently, there was a report in our major journal Circulation, how the National Institutes of Health, for example, is investing time and resources and research. And we also know within the Medical College of Wisconsin here, the Advancing a Healthy Wisconsin, those are also important areas. So huge and important area in which we're learning more. The research needs to be done. And I think that that's how we're going to be able to come up with specific recommendations to be able to mitigate not only heart disease, but also being able to improve health in general.
Let's bring in Katie now in Superior. Katie, what is your question?
Good morning. Very interesting program this morning. I'm curious, what are the appropriate treatment options for a 54-year-old female experiencing PVCs or preventricular contractions? My normal BP is slightly on, it would be considered lower for most people, but my normal is around 90 over 60 or slightly higher, and resting heart rate is upper 60s to low 70s. So I'm wondering what might be appropriate treatments for the PVCs.
Katie, thank you. Dr. Wilson.
Can I ask Katie a quick question?
Sure.
Katie, are you aware of the PVCs based upon taking your pulse or what a watch or a Fitbit tells you, or do you feel the PVCs?
I feel them, and they've been confirmed by a Holter monitor.
Okay. How long have you had them?
Probably since October.
Okay. So it's reasonable to look for environmental possible environmental causes. It might be food, drink, other treatable or reversible exposures. That could be an underlying a cause just because they're new. But if there's not anything in your environment that you can identify, then it's reasonable to look a little further. Skip beats are often innocent. They're often curiosities that remain unexplained, and over time, a lot of people will learn to live with that sensation. Because of your low blood pressure, you might not be able to take some of the medications that usually suppress PVCs, because most of our medicines tend to lower the blood pressure a bit. But looking for an underlying cause for a structural heart problem with an echocardiogram would be reasonable. If you have any family history of heart attack or stroke at an early age, or if you have other risk factors for the problem we were talking about earlier for coronary artery disease or heart attack, then some form of risk assessment is appropriate. You're kind of young to get a coronary calcium score, but that would be a reasonable first step. I don't have the magic pill for you, largely because of your blood pressure, but that's the way we would approach your PVCs. It's just first and foremost to try to find out just how troublesome they are to you and whether we really need to try to suppress them at all.
Take next steps. All right. Well, Katie, thank you for that question. Fielding this last question to both of you, what is the most important thing that we can do today to keep our heart healthy? Dr. Benjamin, you first.
Well, I would certainly say that now is a great time for us to, again, reinvest in the things that will mitigate the risk factors for heart disease. I'm in my 60s. I shared with you that I got on my treadmill, getting 150 minutes, being able to really get that annual checkup and have that conversation with your primary care physician, but really getting the knowledge. There's a fair amount of information and really being more proactive in our health. I think that that will be an incredibly positive influence, not only in your family. And we didn't necessarily bring it up here. Both of us are adult cardiologists. But I think that really being able to model cardiovascular health behavior begins when we're younger. And I think that that will have an incredible positive impact on all of us, including having those lifelong habits that then become part of our normal routine.
Dr. Wilson, what are your thoughts here on the thing we can do to keep our heart healthy?
I couldn't agree more with Dr. Benjamin. It's always easy to say and hard to do. A heart healthy lifestyle is something that you grow to appreciate. You have to invest time and effort, but a healthy diet, Mediterranean style of diet, the DASH diet, are good places to start. And regular aerobic activity, the standard prescription is, as Dr. Benjamin said, 150 minutes a week. Usually that's 30 minutes of uninterrupted aerobic activity, 5 days a week. Those two things, diet and exercise, will go a long way toward improving cardiovascular health for the individual and the country at large. It's better than anything that we have in a pill bottle, that's for sure.
That's so interesting. And over the long haul, diet and exercise, you can't, I would imagine, just think that it's going to happen overnight where you're going to see change.
Oh, absolutely. I tell people don't go on a diet because that implies one day you'll come off a diet. You need to make changes in the way you eat, changes that you find acceptable, desirable, and it has to be slowly done over time.
Thank you both for joining us.
You're Thank you. It was
welcome.
A pleasure.
Dr. Ivor Benjamin, cardiologist, director of the Medical College of Wisconsin Cardiovascular Center in Milwaukee, and Dr. Robert Wilson, a cardiologist with the Appleton-based Heart and Vascular Institute of Wisconsin, treating patients at Ascension Northeast Wisconsin St. Elizabeth campus. And for disclosure, Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Don't miss a moment of Body Week on our show. Listen back at WPR.org/morning. Submit questions and topic ideas with your email to ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.